You're listening to the Jason Greger Show podcast, brought to you by Lakewood Chev. Celebrate Canada's 150th and treat yourself to a brand new Silverado. 20% off MSRP cash credit on select vehicles right now at Lakewood Chev. David Villasorakowicz. I think I said that right without butchering it. Man, that's a mouthful. David, how you doing?
I'm doing good. It's not Commission World Boxing Council. I have to get that straight. Otherwise, Dwayne and Mauricio will never let me come back here. But I'm doing good. It's Friday.
What's the worst butcher job someone's done of your name at an event?
Oh, it probably happened in a country where I can't understand the language. So okay. I'm gonna guess Thailand. France the other week was unique. I learned the French pronunciation of my name, and it's kind of sexy. So I might use that.
You know? There you go. Yeah, that's always good. So how long have you been a judge?
This is going to be my 12th year. I'm into my 12th year and with the WBC now since 2010. So seventh year with the WBC.
So you've been doing this for 12 years. You're based out of Edmonton. You work all over the world. And you mentioned Thailand, you've been in France, or you've been in Mexico tons of time. The boxing atmosphere there is off the charts from what I understand. How do you get into to being a judge at the WBC level coming out of Edmonton?
Well, I think like most officials, everyone starts at some point locally. I mean, you have to have a passion for what you're doing, because when you work locally, you're not doing it for anything but giving back to the sport. You certainly aren't making a living off of it. You know, you're lucky if you, by the time you pay for your dry cleaning and get all the fighter's DNA off your tie and your suit and everything, you're lucky if you pocketed 30, 40 bucks. But, you know, you ply your trade, and I know I can speak for the WBC. There tends to be a bit of a mentoring program that goes on where, whether it be local fight supervisors or other members of the WBC or the NABF, North American Boxing Federation, they tend to just sort of spot who's, you know, working at a consistent level. And that was sort of mentioned to me in 2009, and I was encouraged to attend my first NABF convention, and then followed by the WBC convention. And you basically show up with your eyes and ears open and your mouth closed, and you try to learn as much as you can, get to know the people that are involved, and you basically let other people speak for you. You're not there to solicit fights. In fact, that would work very much against you. But you basically put your time in. I went back after doing my first conventions and went another year and a bit before ever getting a call to work a women's title fight in Mexico City. And that was sort of the first step of my career. And from someone who's from an area where we don't have a lot of events, the mantra for myself and others who, we're blessed to have a few, world-class officials. The mantra that we always carry is don't screw up.
Easier said than done. What makes a good boxing judge?
It's a question I get a lot, because when people find out I do this for a second career, the first question is, did you box, when you were younger? And I wrestled in high school, played, a ton of other sports. But I find that when I look at my peers, the majority of people who are in the sport are very good at critical thinking, thinking under pressure. So you have actually a fair number of people who are involved as officials in the sport who are either retired police, retired military. I know a very good referee in both boxing and MMA as a current prison guard. Accountants, people who can think critically and who can assess things in either high pressure situations, whether it be due to external or internal pressures. But those are the people who tend to excel. You have to have clarity of thought. You have to be able to dial out distractions and things around you, and you have to be able to do it on a consistent basis.
So, the recent one, the Pacquiao-Horn fight, had a lot of people, oh, geez. And, of course, they focus on the one judge who was different, but the reality was the other two judges still had it in Horn's favor anyway. I think it was 115 to 113. And when you score a fight as a judge, when you're scoring a round, right, usually it's 10-9, unless there's a real dominant one, then it's 10-8 the odd time, because you have to determine a winner, right? Like, even if – can you go 9-9 or 10-10? Like – or do you have to, in your mind, decide every round there's a legit winner?
Well, you in a 10-point must system, which is a system that we work under, you always have to have at least one corner having a score of 10. So it's either going to be a 10-9. You can have an even round. They are rare, but they do happen. I think you'll find more 10-10 rounds to happen sort of at lower levels. when you're working championship bouts, you're there for a reason. You're there to determine the winner of a round. I mean, it's I haven't scored a 10-10 round in a world championship fight at a major level. I've scored a handful, probably I think less than five in all my years prior to. But you know, you are there to render a decision. So you have your criteria of you know, the most important is clean, effective punches. Then you have, you know, there are the four sort of categories that people are familiar with over the years. But in the last couple of years, we've been exposed to sort of a new system, a way of looking things where it really reduces it to three sort of main criteria. And it's called the three D's of the sport. And it was sort of introduced by an excellent judge out of North Carolina, Barry Lindemann. And it's basically simply damage, domination, and disruption. So are you doing enough to damage your opponent, which typically that refers to your clean, effective punches that cause, you know, visible discomfort in the opponent. Are you dominating your opponent, which means, you know, are you controlling everything in the round? And then the third one is, are you disrupting your opponent, meaning are you preventing him from doing what he wants to do in the ring?
Okay.
And for example, when we talked about the Pacquiao-Horn fight, and I finally actually had a chance to actually properly score it, there was Horn was doing what he needed to do to try to effectively win the fight. So he was disrupting Manny Pacquiao in a lot of ways. Manny didn't become Manny until about round eight of that fight, where finally he was starting to look like the Manny Pacquiao that a lot of people are used to seeing. I think it's really easy if you're watching the fight as a fan to see the fight and not be impressed with Horn's style. It was not a pretty fight, and it was probably a very mentally exhausting fight to score. But Horn did what he needed to do with the limitations of the skills he had and was very effective in doing so. There were rounds where Horn was damaging Manny, absolutely. There was definitely rounds where he was disrupting Manny a lot. And the dominance, I'm not sure if you could say any one fighter dominated the other, but
except the one round. I think it was round eight or nine.
Round
by Pacquiao.
Nine. Yeah. Yeah. Round nine is when, you know, Manny came alive and Manny was Manny. And, you know, you could have very easily have had that round, a 10-8 round. That being said, Manny of old probably would not have let anybody get out of round nine. You know,
should that matter in a fight when you're scoring a fight? Is it hard to block out what your expectations are from what you've seen from a fighter many times? And if they're not doing what they've done in the past, how do you block that out at a judge? Or is it natural to have that thinking about, oh geez, look at his punches. He's not really getting any damage where he used to. If he connect with a left hook, you'd see the other guy maybe keel over, but show that one hurt them. If suddenly they're not, does that illustrate that maybe his, even though it's a direct punch, but it's not as damaging as it used to be? Does that get held against a guy?
Well, I don't know if it would be held against. I think a lot of it is in the preparation of an official. I know, for example, when I'm assigned a contest, I don't want to watch any previous film of any of the two combatants that are going to be in my upcoming fight. I want to basically know as little about their styles so I don't have any preconceived notions going into a contest. What I tend to do, and I've got hours and hours of tape on my PVR, when I get a fight assignment, what I try to do is I just try to watch and bone up on video of fights in that weight category. So I want to get used to, if they're heavyweights, I want to know that, I want to get familiar with the fact that heavyweights are going to probably be working at a slower pace, but they're going to be causing a lot more damage with their punches. So I need to make sure I'm dialed into seeing what kind of effects are happening with the punches. When I'm doing, lightweights like I did in France, there's a speed factor, there's a footwork factor involved, and you just got to get familiar with how bodies of that weight category move. And that's what I tend to brush up on. And those are things I've learned from peers who have now become friends in the sport. Our pool of officials tends to be small enough that I think it's always a wise thing to try to learn from your peers and how they prepare for a fight. And I've been blessed to have quite a few mentors, Steve Morrow in California, who's done a tremendous number of world title fights. He's probably been one of my main mentors. Max DeLuca, I mentioned earlier, I'm fortunate enough to call him friends and mentors. And it's quite often where we'll get together and privately on social media after fights, and we'll ask each other, hey, how did you have this round? How did you have that round? What did you think of that fight? How would you have approached, this particular round? And because, our pool is, like I said, is very limited. So our resources as far as people who are, you know, training us. A lot of times we get together maybe once, twice a year to go over and spend a day of breaking down video. But you can't just rely on the fact that you're doing, you know, 1 8-hour session every 6 months. It's incumbent on you as an official to improve yourself. And so I think a lot of us do, you know, our own video work and stay sharp.
David Bilosorkowicz, a WBC judge, joins us. We'll take a break. I want to come back. I want to talk about, as a guy, you've judged both boxing and you've done some MMA cards. So a guy who's seen it up front. We'll talk a little bit about Mayweather, McGregor. Also, I want to talk about the Edmonton Combative Sports Commission, your views on some of those things. I know you've of course, used to judge fights here in Edmonton. We'll get to that and more when we return on Edmonton Sports Leader TSN 1260. In studio with the WBC judge, David Bilosorkowicz. And Dave, having judged both world title fights at the boxing level, you've judged MMA. Everybody's asking, so I got to ask you, guy who sat that close, what's your thoughts on Mayweather McGregor? And you look at Mayweather, no one could ever hit him, even Pacquiao and the other great boxers. When you look at it, can McGregor hit him?
It's anything's possible. I was talking to a friend of mine who's also a fight official, and we came up with a pretty apt analogy. You could take the world's best cricket batsman. I don't know who he is or where he is, but you could take the absolute best in the world and you could put him in the batter's box against Madison Bumgarner and he's not going to hit anything. You know, it's just a different game. Everything that McGregor has been taught to do in terms of punching, in terms of MMA versus boxing.
Yeah, like the footwork is going to be the biggest one, right? Oh. Because in you almost lead with your opposite foot, do you not?
Exactly. Yeah, your balance is almost completely backwards. Because in MMA, when you're striking to do other things. So it's usually off your back foot. So your weight transfer is usually never there compared to boxing. So in terms of what this event is going to be, and you know, event/spectacle, I think it's going to go as long as Floyd wants it to go. I'm not going to predict who's going to win or lose. It's not my place to do that. But, as far as my interest level goes, I wouldn't pay to watch it if they were fighting on my front lawn, to be honest with you. I think there's far better fights coming up, including the week after that with the Chocolatito and a Rungvisai rematch. And then 2 weeks after that, Triple G and Canelo. I mean, those are the fights to watch. But
yeah, if you want to see elite level boxing, then those are the ones to watch.
Absolutely. You know, it's going to be an event, and I think it's going to draw in the casual or semi-casual fan who's looking for, you know, the three ring circus. And
it seems most people are like, well, I'm only watching in the hopes that McGregor knocks him out.
Anybody who steps in the ring has a chance, and McGregor has a puncher's chance. I mean, it's not like he doesn't know what he's doing as far as combat sports and how to defend himself and stuff. But like you mentioned it, you know, Floyd Mayweather has had a very lengthy career in not getting hit by some of the best.
And I can't stand him as a human being. So let me just clarify that too. So
yeah. And you know, obviously everyone's entitled to their opinion and I'm going to keep mine to myself, for sake of, being allowed to come back on again. but yeah, like the fight itself, if you can call it that, it's an event. It's going to be a slash spectacle. And in the sport of boxing, it's not uncommon for this type of thing to happen. I mean, Muhammad Ali went to Japan and fought a pro wrestler, I think Inoue, back in the late 70s, early 80s. And it was probably very much the same type of thing. You know, I'm sure the Tokyo Dome sold out, you know, 75,000 people.
Oh, yeah.
And everybody made a lot of money.
Yeah, and Ali was a showman for sure.
Absolutely. So, it's from my perspective, it's very little, it barely moves the interest needle for me. But there are going to be a lot of people going to watch it.
Oh yeah. There'll be tons, I think, for sure. Now you of course started locally, and now, you do WBC. You haven't judged a fight in Edmonton since when?
Since then, December of 2011.
And so when you're a WBC judge, you still could work fights here, correct?
I seemingly can work anywhere in the world but Edmonton. And I should probably clarify that within about 2 weeks prior to that, I was part of joining then Councillor Ron Hader, former ECSE chairman Usman Ali, and I think there were six of us in total. We launched a 12-page formal complaint to the city of Edmonton in regards to the current executive director, which was a pretty lengthy and detailed laundry list of major concerns and what we thought were serious violations. And only to have that all, for lack of a better term, swept under the rug with a three-paragraph, one-page explanation that didn't satisfy anybody. And then suddenly a bunch of us found ourselves on the outside looking in, on the bench, as we call it.
So you basically said, here's some things we don't see that are run professional. They said, okay, we disagree with you. And then as somebody who does world title fights, they felt you weren't qualified to judge events in Edmonton?
Well, the Pat Reed actually didn't give me a reason. He said I wasn't going to be working for Edmonton anymore. And I said, oh, okay. Care to explain why. And he either had selective amnesia or refused to give me a reason. And as our conversation went round and round, he finally let something slip and then caught himself. And that this conversation was witnessed by somebody else. So it's not like I'm here making anything up. Knowing or reading what has come out with the work that Mike Russell has done, which has been
true. And Real Fight Stories, yeah, we had him on last week.
Yeah. Only then did we start to realize that the people we were complaining to were the people who gave him his job to begin with. So it was kind of a fool's errand on our part to complain. But I guess when you look at the situation prior to the Tim Haig tragedy, there has been a tremendous amount of knowledgeable stakeholders in not only Edmonton, but in Alberta and in Canada, who have been raising red flag after red flag after red flag towards the city. I know myself and a former commission member who was on the original hiring committee sat down with Councillor Ben Henderson, and we presented a very lengthy list of major concerns that we had about what was happening at the time. And I guess I could paraphrase or characterize that the results of that meeting as we were given the pat on the head and thanked for our efforts, and you know, nothing went anywhere. It's a very awful feeling to wake up one morning and read the news that Tim Haig was fighting for his life in a hospital. And my first reaction upon hearing that was, it finally happened. It's an awful feeling to paraphrase or to use an analogy of trying to yell at a bunch of people who are playing on a train track that a train's coming, because you can see it coming, and because they can't, they refuse to get off the tracks. And when the train finally hits, there's no feeling of vindication there. I remember waking up that morning feeling very angry that this had come to pass, because in a lot of people's opinion, not only mine or people who aren't working for the commission, I'm in contact with a lot of people who are currently working and who have to basically, for lack of a better term, shut up if they want to keep working, who knew that something like this was a matter of inevitability.
If David Bilo-Sirkowicz joins us, he's a WBC judge, been there since 2009. Of course, did work in Edmonton up until 2011. And you've done, as I mentioned, title fights in at WBC level, which no offense to any of the cards we've had in Edmonton. We don't have cards that well. So if you can judge at that high level, I would assume it's kind of like the NHL, that if you can ref there, you probably should be able to ref in the American League, if we want to call it that. You mentioned how you guys had a laundry list of concerns many years ago. And you said how sadly, you maybe saw something tragic occurring. What does Edmonton need to do? And I guess even the province, because Alberta is the only one that doesn't have a provincial commission. Getting a provincial commission would help, but only if you had the right person running the commission.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm not against the concept of having a provincial commission. But I think it's important to point out that prior to 2010, the Edmonton Combative Sports Commission was considered to be one of the best in the country back in the days when it was run by people like Ron Hader and Orris Mindak and Ed Pearson and Usman Ali and people like that. It was Edmonton and Montreal who were the two experts in the field, if you want to call it, in Canada. Edmonton ran very well also on a part-time basis of an annual budget of about $23,000 a year, and had upon the introduction of the current regime, over $150,000 in funds that they've accrued and financed and managed properly. So it was a very tight ship, and it ran very well. Ron Hader should be commended immensely for setting the standards that a lot of us came up under. And, we all learned through, you know, his disciples that, you know, right was right and wrong was wrong. And, you know, you did things a certain way. You carried yourself a certain way. You didn't cut corners. The thing about the fight game is if everybody who is involved in it, from administration to commissioning to the promoters, to the officials of the day of the fight, if we all do our job to the best of our abilities and follow the rules 100% to the letter, the risk to the two fighters that are going into that cage or into that ring is still immense. I mean, they call it the hurt business. It's not just a saying. At any link in that chain, if you start weakening that chain by cutting corners, no matter where it is, the risk to the fighters increases exponentially. And there were enough things happening. I mean, the Ryan Jimmo Thierry Sudoku fight was an MMA fight where, you know.
Yeah, they let Sudoku take his gloves home.
People in this sport get banned for life for that thing. Panama Lewis has been barred from doing any more fights in the U.S. and Canada for life due to the Billy Irwin incident.
Which was?
Where they found padding was taken out of the gloves. And, you know, Billy Irwin basically suffered an assault in the ring. Antonio Margarito's trainer, when they found plaster in his hand wraps after the fight in his fight against Miguel Cotto, where Cotto took a tremendous beating in that fight, he's been banned for life in the U.S. I mean, these aren't just trivial things. Somebody could have died in the ring that night. And it equates to other things like matchmaking and making sure. I mean, Andy Foster, who's executive officer in the state of California, has come up with a tremendous system. It's a sort of fighter damage index system where he has a formula, and he's shared this with commissions at the Association of Boxing Commissions conventions, and he welcomes other commissions to use this system, where he comes up with a fight formula where potential fights, he ranks them, and it's from a 1 to 9, and a guy who's rated at 1 is never going to fight a guy who's rated at 7. You know, if there's more than the 3-point spread, he refuses the fight. Those type of things don't seem to happen here. You know, I emailed you after David Whittem, who's now currently in a coma in Ontario, who his previous fight was fought in Edmonton, and he lost, I think at that time, 7 out of 9 fights, and I think majority of them by knockout.
Yeah.
And I remember emailing you that morning and I said, you know, in his very next fight in Ontario, he suffered a brain bleed and he's currently in a coma. And I emailed you that morning and I said, do you realize how close Edmonton came for that to happen? You know, it could have been one more punch, one more round. And Mike Russell had spoken to a tremendous neurologist, Dr. Helen Clausen, who's our WBC, basically brain specialist, one of the most brilliant people on the planet in terms of brain injury and concussions and things like that. And those type of injuries they don't tend to happen just at once. They tend to happen over a long period of time. So, I mean, at that time, I mean, I remember emailing you saying, you know, Edmonton just dodged such a major bullet. And then the very next fight card, you know, we have the Tim Hegg tragedy, which, I mean, I just feel awful for their family. It's something, the commissions exist, and we do our jobs to protect the fighters mostly from themselves.
Yeah.
And if we're putting fighters in harm's way by not doing our jobs or not reporting results of bouts and things like that, we're aiding in the end result. And it's a horrible thing. And anybody who's involved, who would cut a corner or who would let something slide should really take a serious look at themselves as far as what they're doing, even doing in this sport. It's not about personal agendas. We do this because we love the game, and it's at its best, it's a beautiful sport, and it's a tremendous test of will and character, and it's lifted a lot of people out of poverty and made them into kings. You know, Manny Pacquiao, for example, like you mentioned earlier, he went from selling gum on the streets of General Santos City at 3 years old to being, he's going to probably be president of the country in a couple of years. I mean, that's what that sport can give you. But we all have to remember that our role is to protect the fighters at all times. And I really hope that this so-called third party investigation is an actual legitimate investigation. I have, in my own experience in dealing with the city and the ECSC on other serious matters, my confidence level that this is anything but a dog and pony show on a scale of 1 to 10, 10 being the most confident, is about a -6.
Well, that's not great news. And, you know, I know I wrote it in the Edmonton Journal earlier this week that I think they owe it to the boxing community, they owe it to the Haig family to ensure that when you say third party, it has to be nobody from the current Edmonton Combative Sports Commission. That'd be like, hey, you know what? I got a ticket. I want to go appeal to it to myself. Like, hey, I don't think I was doing that wrong. Okay, good. Excellent. We agree. Perfect. It makes no sense. And there should be nobody involved in city management on this third party commission who is overseeing the Edmonton Combative Sports, because they're going to have a natural bias whether they want to or not. And I don't know who the exact answer is. Maybe get people from other commissions. There has to be enough people that can look and say, okay, because all they have to do simply is to say, okay, were the proper rules followed? Did they follow the bylaws? That's why the bylaws are there. Did they follow the bylaws? Was there enough time? Was Haig legally allowed to be fighting based on the current bylaws? That's really the only rule they have to look at. And if they see that that's not the truth, then they need to know, well, why? What's the reason why? Did he have a meeting with a neurologist who cleared him? Because I know that's in the bylaws that states if you have a 60-day suspension, the neurologist deems you clear. Okay, great. I'm not sure any neurologist would do that, but maybe we don't know. So that's what the investigation, I would hope, uncovers. But I'm curious to see where it goes from here, because this could have long-term negative effects on the boxing community in Edmonton. And there's a lot of people that have come out of here Julian Emerjanovic, obviously world champion, nine times over. You know, Scotty Bulldog Olsen was a great fighter for a long time. You know, Kenny Lacusti, go back. Lots of really good fighters. And there's a few others coming out of Edmonton recently. And if they don't have that opportunity, you know, because the worst mistake would be, we're just going to walk away and we're going to ban from it. And we just want to wash our hands of it. That, to me, that doesn't solve the problem. That's the easy way out, right?
Yeah, I mean, and you look at the city of Edmonton's own minutes as far as what the agenda has appeared to be within the ECSC. I think it's discouraging to look at, you know, as an ongoing basis where the city has been given information by a numerous amount of stakeholders who can really be, I guess, considered at certain levels experts in the field, from former commissioners to former executive directors to media members to officials to ex-commission members who have been drummed out by the current regime. I guess the city has taken the approach, and I can only assume by their actions, is that they would have preferred to pass this along. Their agendas based on their minutes is that they have been pushing to move the Edmonton Commission into a role to head the province. And that's not a way to fix the problems. It appears to me as if it's a way to offload the problems and to avoid any damage along the way. And now we have a situation where we have a dead body and a dead fighter. And it's really going to be interesting what's going to happen in the next while. I fear that the Haig family is going to have to probably undergo a lengthy ordeal, via some sort of litigation or legal proceedings to find out the real facts. Because I like you, I want to know what's been going on the last month. If there's a death in any other work site, you know, I have a friend of mine that say he works at a chemical plant out in Fort Saskatchewan. They had a tragic death on the work site. Everything was stopped immediately. Offices were closed, no emails, no paperwork. Everything gets shut down. There's a full investigation. Nothing, you don't wait a month when someone's died to figure out how you're going to investigate it. In my opinion, the easiest way would have been to call another commission, whether it be Calgary, whether it be Ontario, whether it be BC, whether it be California, and say, okay, we need you to A, take control of this situation, and you pick who's going to investigate it. That's an independent third party. Hearing, you know, this come out of the city that there's, you know, the people who are directly involved are having input as to how we're going to pick and who we're going to pick. All that leads me to think is that they're just trying to figure out who's going to give them the result they want.
Yeah, that definitely doesn't look good. Quickly, upcoming boxing matches that you recommend for any of our fans, because a lot of boxing in North America, definitely not as big worldwide. It's still a massive sport. So I think at times it doesn't get the North American coverage. So some people think it's dying, but worldwide it's massive. If you could only watch one fight in the next month, which would you recommend for people that are looking to watch the Sweet Science?
If I was going to do one pay-per-view, and I'm not here endorsing anybody officially, but the rare chance I get to speak as a fight fan, the Canelo Alvarez Triple G fight, that's the event. That's the true event of the year, in my opinion. If you don't want to do a pay-per-view and you're fortunate enough to have HBO, the week before that is the Rungvisai Chocolatito rematch, which... Okay. I had a bunch of people over my place barbecuing and stuff, including former Eskimo Craig Ellis, who he almost was beside himself during watching that fight. And my friends who are listening will all be laughing at the same time. But that was just, that already is considered fight of the year.
Okay. And
again, it's the sport's doing tremendously well. There's we probably haven't had the last 2 years like we've had in many. You know, when you look at Klitschko Joshua, 90,000 people in Wembley Stadium. You know, last year I did the Celia Brakhus and Matisse fight in Norway, first pro fight in Norway in 32 years. 10,000 seats sold out in 8 minutes. Boxing is in a very healthy state, and it's actually now improving in the U.S. because I think for the longest time, the U.S. caliber,
they didn't have a big name guy.
That's right. Yeah. So you know how the American media works; it tends to fall right off the map. Now you've got Deontay Wilder, you've got Andre Ward, you've got Terrence Crawford. You've got a very good crop of American fighters, and it looks like the worm's turning. The ESPN fight, even the Horn Pacquiao fight, that was I think ESPN's biggest rated for ratings in the last decade or something like that. So it's in a very healthy place, I think it's going to stay that way.
David, really good insight, man. Cool job that you have. That's David Bilicerkowicz. He is a judge with WBC, and of course, that's just one of his jobs. What's your other gig that you're doing full time?
Actually, come full circle. You and I both came from farming background, so I'm back in the ag business.
Are you back in it? Smart business. Hey, that's where the money's at. We appreciate it. Thanks for your time, Dave.
No problem.